Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Supreme Court when we come back. You know, once in a while we get a glimpse of the real world through the eyes of an insider like John Swinton, for instance. Swinton was the guest of honor at a banquet given to him by the leaders of his craft back in 1880. And someone who knew neither the press nor John Swinton offered a toast to the independent press. And Swinton outraged his colleagues by replying that there's no such thing at this date of world history in America as an independent press. Now, you know it and I know it, he said. And there's not one of you who dares to write your honest opinions, and if you did, you know beforehand that it would never appear in print. Now, I'm paid weekly for keeping my honest opinions out of the paper that I'm connected with, and others of you are paid similar salaries for similar things. And any of you who would be so foolish as to write your honest opinions would be out on the streets looking for another job. And if I allowed my honest opinions to appear in one issue of my paper before 24 hours, my occupation would be gone. The business of the journalist is to destroy the truth, to lie outright, to pervert, to vilify, to fawn at the feet of mammon and to sell his country and his race for his daily bread. Now, you know it and I know it. And what folly is this toasting of an independent press? We are, he said, the tools and vassals of rich men behind the scenes. We are the jumping jacks. They pull the strings and we dance. Our talents, our possibilities, and our lives are all the property of other men. We are intellectual prostitutes. Now, you know, these rich men behind the scenes are the movers and shakers of the Global 2000 program. It's this new world order. The men and families like the Windsors and Rockefellers and Bushes and Bundys and Carnegies and Vanderbilts. That's why I contend it's time for us to wise up and start listening more to the God of Abraham and stop following after all these crazy scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians. And let's prepare to live through and survive this new world order, this Global 2000 insanity. Now, if you'd like to learn more about Global 2000 and Bible prophecy and this new world order, why don't you call and order our free general law compact disc package. Remember, it's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative. Best of all, it's free. You can call right now and order one. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Now, once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget? The Supreme Court is in the news. Justice Souter just resigned as I speak, and President Obama is considering who's going to be his replacement. And pretty shortly, we'll have a new replacement to the Supreme Court. Happens a couple of times, typically, in every presidential cycle, every presidential term of office. We'll have, not everyone, but, you know, typically there'll be one or two of these replacements. There's 9 men here in the United States that sit on what we call the Supreme Court of the United States. It is the highest court in the land. There are many courts, both municipal. Let's just take a look at how they work here. Like in New York City, we have Judge Judy. She's on television. And she handles little cases that occur among people down at the lower level, like landlord and tenant conflicts, you know. And then as you go up the ladder here, you'll have what's called a county court. Judge Judy presides over what's sometimes called a Justice of the Peace court, or a small claims court, something on that order. And then as you go up the ladder here, you come to your county courts. Here in Missouri, they're called Associate Circuit Courts. And then there's a court right above that called the Circuit Court. The Associate Circuit Court is a court where you take your traffic tickets and divorces and things like that. And then when you get into the county court, or as we call them here, the circuit courts, then they handle things like, it could be murder or bank robbery, or you could be suing somebody, you know, for a breach of contract or something on that order. And then if you don't like the decision that you get out of these courts, we have an appellate process. And so here in Missouri, you take it to the Court of Appeals. Ours here in our district or our area is located in Springfield, Missouri. Then if you don't like the decision that you get out of the Court of Appeals, you can appeal to the State Supreme Court. And that's the highest court that we have here in the state of Missouri. But there's one more appeal that can be taken to the United States Supreme Court if there's a federal law or a federal question to be decided. So if the state courts, starting out down here at the Justice of the Peace level and going on up to your state Supreme Court, don't avail you of the decision you're looking for, then you can finally appeal to the United States Supreme Court. And if you lose there, there is no further appeal. That's why it's called the highest court in the land. You have to, litigation has to stop someplace, and in this country it stops at the Supreme Court. Now, a question arises as to whether or not this court is political, and whether or not it's economic, or whether it's just there for the purposes of justice, just here to decide who's right and who's wrong. And once we get down to the question of, well, who's right and who's wrong, who decides? Who is it that decides right from wrong? Well, here in the United States, we call it the people, the sovereignty of the people. The people decide. All power is vested in the sovereignty, and the sovereignty is vested in the people. And the people are the ones that created the Constitution, and it is in the name of the people of the state of Missouri, or the people of the state of California, that these criminal processes are brought. In fact, your complaint is going to say the state of Missouri versus Joe Sixpack. And then when you get into this court, there's a fella in there, and he wears a black robe. And he sits up on an elevated platform over here and conducts the proceedings, and it's a mysterious proceeding. Most people don't understand the proceedings that go on here in court. They might go in and watch it, but they don't really know what it is and what it is that's coming down or what's going on around them. But they've been in there a time or two, and they all know they hate it. They don't like it. Most people are afraid to go into court. It's a place of terror. It's a place to be terrorized. It's a place to be feared. Now, the reality of it is the judicial system, the court system, was founded by Moses out at Mount Sinai. We'll get into that a little later, and we'll take a look at Moses and the appellate process and the judicial process and judges and priests and how the system works. You get the Levitical priesthood and the Aaronic priesthood. Here in the United States, we have the federal judiciary and we have the state judiciary. But Foundations of Liberty put out a booklet, and I did one of these a couple of weeks ago. It's called Foundations of Liberty, and it's a booklet that's put out twice a month by the East Moline Christian School. So if you'd like to have a copy of it, it's entitled The Supreme Court. I don't know if you can still get a copy of it. This one's probably years old. I can't tell you that you can or can't, but more than likely, they typically will have reprints of their articles and their publications. And so this one's called The Supreme Court. And it's called the East Moline Christian School. They're at 946th Avenue, East Moline, Illinois. The zip code is 61244. And the editor is James R. Patrick. James R. Patrick is the editor of the East Moline Christian School Foundations of Liberty publication. And the article starts off with W. Cleon Skousen. Now, Skousen is a scholar. He's written a number of books on freedom and freedom issues and government and one thing and another. He's pretty famous guy. And he wrote a treatise called The Most Powerful Judiciary in the World. And that's where we start with our analysis here of the Supreme Court. Just across the park from the Capitol building in Washington, D.C., stands a massive, impressive structure of white marble with giant fluted pillars. And above those pillars are inscribed the words, Equal Justice Under Law. This is the Supreme Court of the United States of America. Every American should know more about what happens behind these massive marble facades of pillars and statues, which marks the entrance to the Supreme Court building. It is there from the first Monday in October until late the following June that the world's most powerful body of judicial magistrates proclaims the latest version of what must be accepted as the supreme law of the land for more than 300 million Americans. And behind it all, there is an interesting story. Now, the founding fathers were determined to build a new kind of civilization specifically designed to preserve human freedom on a permanent basis. No nation had ever permanently achieved that goal before. In fact, during more than 5,000 years of world government, government had represented dungeons, executions, heavy taxes, serfdom, and for millions of people, just outright slavery. The founders of the United States of America therefore looked upon government as an inescapable necessity, but a highly dangerous instrument. And this led George Washington to say that government is not reason. It is not eloquence. It is force. And like fire, it is a dangerous servant and a fearful master. Now, why is government so likely to become a fearful master? The founders believed that was because government consists of nothing more than a conglomerate of human beings who have within their basic nature the instinct to continuously expand whatever power is placed in their hands. And this is true not only of evil men, but of public-spirited and well-meaning men as well. So the founding fathers understood human nature. And Thomas Jefferson wrote and put it this way. He said, "It would be a dangerous delusion were a confidence in the men of our choice to silence our fears for the safety of our rights. That confidence is everywhere the parent of despotism. Free government is founded in jealousy and not in confidence. It is jealousy and not confidence which prescribes limited constitutions to bind down those whom we are obliged to trust with power. That our Constitution has accordingly fixed the limits to which, and no further, our confidence may go." In questions of power, then, let no more be said of confidence in man, but bind him down from mischief by the chains of the Constitution. But what chains of the Constitution shall be used? Based upon their study of the past, plus the hard-learned lessons of their own colonial experience, our founding fathers came up with the following formula. First of all, they said, let's assign to the government only specific and limited powers. Second, let us separate the powers of government vertically, into local, state, and federal, and then horizontally by legislative, executive, and judicial. Third, let us then provide a system of checks and balances between the various departments and levels of government, so that there is a built-in system of self-repair which can deal with abuses of power by peaceful means and not require the people to resort to revolution again. And fourth, we need to record the desires and the intentions of the people in a written constitution which will remain inflexible and never changing except by amendment. Fifth, let us control the human instinct to continually grasp for additional power by restraining those in governmental offices with the inflexible chains of the Constitution. Never allow those restraints to become obsolete or neglected. Human nature does not change, and experience has demonstrated that the rights of the people will ultimately be shattered if the constitutional barriers are allowed to be broken down. Sixth, let us set up a guardian to see that these constitutional provisions are strictly enforced. So how the Supreme Court evolved into its present role as guardian of the Constitution? Well, the gradual evolution of the Supreme Court into its role as guardian of the Constitution is known as the power of judicial review. And this means that the court can review acts of Congress and acts of the state legislatures to make certain that they do not violate the provisions of the Constitution as designed by our founding fathers. Now, it's interesting that this extremely important power under which the Supreme Court makes its judicial review of constitutional issues is not specifically spelled out in the Constitution. However, it is clearly implied by the so-called Supremacy Clause, which makes the Constitution and the federal laws and treaties the supreme law of the land. So, obviously, the Supreme Court would have to use its judicial powers to enforce the Supremacy Clause, since otherwise it would be meaningless. That this was the intent of at least some of the founders is borne out by the words of Alexander Hamilton. The courts were designed to be an intermediate body between the people and the legislature, in order, among other things, to keep the latter, the legislature, the congressional Congress within its limits assigned to it by their authority. The interpretation of the laws is the proper and peculiar province of the courts. A constitution is, in fact, and must be regarded by the judges as a fundamental law. It therefore belongs to them, the judiciary, to ascertain its meaning as well as the meaning of any particular act proceeding from the legislative body. If there should happen to be an incorrect variance between the two, that which has the superior obligation and validity ought, of course, to be preferred. Or, in other words, the Constitution ought to be preferred to the statute, and the intention of the people to be the intention of their agent. So, in other words, the Supreme Court is to measure all legislative acts against the will of the people, as it was set forth in their original Charter of Liberties, the Constitution of the United States. Now, there's been a major weakness discovered, but there was and is in one thing that is missing here, and what happens if the Supreme Court imposes its will upon the nation, contrary to the specific provisions of the Constitution. The founders knew that this possibility did in fact exist, and Alexander Hamilton wrote of such a possibility when he said, "The courts must declare the sense of the law, and if they should be disposed to exercise will instead of judgment, the consequence would be equally the substitution of their pleasure to that of the legislative body." So Hamilton had already pointed out that an unconstitutional act of the legislative body is null and void. And it should be clear, then, that an unconstitutional edict by the Supreme Court would be equally invalid. But if this happens, where is the remedy? And by what means do the people protect themselves? Now, apparently, the founders were so concerned about an overzealous Congress that they neglected to protect themselves from an overzealous judiciary. The only checks and balances provided in the Constitution are as follows. First, all judges have to be appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. Second, Article 3, Section 2 authorized the Congress to restrict the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court, but this has been rarely attempted. And three, the Congress can impeach judges for treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors, but not for an unpopular decision, even when the Supreme Court has seriously violated its constitutional limitations by making new laws through judicial decree. No effective congressional action has been asserted. From this, it will be readily seen that insofar as checks on the judiciary are concerned, a major loophole was left in the basic structure of the Constitution. And perhaps the founders were too busy to read an article in the New York paper signed Brutus, who was believed to have been Robert Yates back in colonial times, which said, "It's of great importance to examine with care the nature and extent of the judicial power, because those Supreme Court judges are to be rendered totally independent, both of the people of the legislature, both with respect to their offices and salaries. No errors they commit can be corrected. And the only causes for which they can be displaced are convictions of treason, bribery, and high crimes and misdemeanors. The power of the judicial will enable them to mold the government into almost any shape that they please." Now, of course, the founders may have assumed that the members of the Supreme Court would adhere to the traditional principles of strict interpretation, which had been thoroughly established during several centuries of English common law. Had this been done, modern Americans would find themselves living in a much more stable society than at present. And our history demonstrates that too often the Supreme Court has ignored clearly stated principles of the founders and interpreted the Constitution to suit the social, economic, or political aspirations of the court. This proved to be the Achilles heel in the structure of the Constitution, which allowed the Supreme Court to rapidly become what Brutus predicted that it would become. This then brings us to a very important question. Who was right in this conflict? Was it Chief Justice Marshall, or was it Thomas Jefferson? Well, the bitter controversy over who should be the guardian of the Constitution was personified in two equally devout American patriots who were cousins. One was Thomas Jefferson, who wanted the states to protect the people from the abusive federal government, and the other cousin was John Marshall, who was the second Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and he wanted the Supreme Court to protect the people from the arbitrary abuses of the various states. These men had much in common. They were both trained in law by George Wythe. Wythe was one of the foremost legal minds in colonial America. Both men had a reverential love for the Constitution as a charter of human liberty. Both of them considered the people to be the source of all political authority, and both looked upon the Constitution as the expressed will of the people. Both of these men cherished freedom as a sacred and unalienable legacy which had to be preserved if the great American experiment were to endure. And at the bottom line, Both men considered the primary purpose of government to be the protection of the people's rights. But in spite of all of this unity, these two great patriots came to divergent conclusions as to how best to guard the Constitution against intrusion. Jefferson believed that the greatest threat was a strong central government. He therefore considered the independent rights reserved to the states as the best safeguard against federal abuse and usurpation. Marshall, on the other hand, had served in the Virginia state legislature four times between 1782 and 1795, and he had seen enough chicanery on the state level to convince him that what the people needed was a uniformity of interpretation by the Supreme Court, so as to make sure that the rights of all of the people were protected on an equal basis in all of the states. And to that end, the fears of both men turned out to have merit. The federal government did extend its powers far beyond the dimensions allowed by the Constitution, and the states did impose upon their people a wide variety of arbitrary standards concerning the manner and extent to which the rights of the people would be protected. Now, 200 years later, Americans are still seeking the best solutions. Those which are currently being considered need to be evaluated in terms of what both Jefferson and Marshall expressed in their various opinions. First of all, let us consider Jefferson's strong objections to the Supreme Court being set up as the exclusive and final arbiter of what the Constitution means. Jefferson's objections to judicial review as the final word for all other branches of government went like this. While serving as president, Jefferson wrote the following to Abigail Adams. He said, "You seem to think it devolved on the judges to decide on the validity of the sedition law. But nothing in the Constitution has given the Supreme Court a right to decide for the executive more than to the executive to decide for them. Both magistrates are equally independent in the sphere of action assigned to them. The judges, believing the law constitutional, had a right to pass a sentence of fine and imprisonment because the power was placed in their hands by the Constitution. But the executives, believing the law to be unconstitutional, were bound to remit the execution of it because that power has been confided to them by the Constitution. That instrument meant that its coordinate branches should be checks on each other. But the opinion which gives to the judges the right to decide what laws are constitutional and what laws are not constitutional, not only for themselves in their own sphere of action, but for the legislature and executive also in their spheres, would make the judiciary a despotism." Now, sometime later, Jefferson stressed the same point even more emphatically. He said, "The Constitution intended that the three great branches of the government should be coordinate and independent of each other. As to acts, therefore, which are to be done by either, it has given no control to another branch. It did not intend to give the judiciary control over the executive, and I have long wished for a proper occasion to have the gratuitous opinion in Marbury versus Madison brought before the public and denounced as not being law." And again, he said, this is Thomas Jefferson, he said, "My construction of the Constitution is that each department is truly independent of the others, and it has an equal right to decide for itself what is the meaning of the Constitution in the cases submitted to its action, and especially where it is to act ultimately and without appeal." And then finally, he came right out and pronounced judicial review to be a dangerous doctrine. In 1820, he wrote to William Charles Jarvis, and he said, "You seem to consider the judges as the ultimate arbiters of all constitutional questions. That's a very dangerous doctrine, and one which would place us under the despotism of an oligarchy. Our judges are as honest as other men, and not more so. They have with others the same passions for party, for power, and for privilege of their corps. Their power is the more dangerous as they are in office for life and not responsible as the other functionaries are to the elective control of the people. The Constitution has erected no such single tribunal, knowing that to whatever hands confided with the corruptions of time and party, its members would become despots. It has more wisely made all of the departments co-equal and co-sovereign within themselves. If the Congress fails to pass laws for a census, for paying the judges and other officers of government, for establishing a militia, for naturalization as prescribed by the Constitution, or if they fail to meet in Congress, the judges cannot issue them their mandamus. If the president fails to supply the place of a judge, to appoint other civil or military officers, to issue requisite commissions, the judges cannot force him. They can issue their mandamus or distraint as to executive or legislative office or officers to enforce the fulfillment of their official duties, any more than the President or Congress may issue orders to the judges or to their officers. Betrayed by English example, and unaware, as it should seem, of the control of our Constitution in this particular, they have at times overstepped their limit by undertaking to command executive officers in the discharge of their executive duties. But the Constitution, in keeping three departments distinct and independent, restrains the authority of the judges to judiciary organs, as it does the executive and legislative to executive and legislative organs. When the legislative or executive functionaries act unconstitutionally, they are responsible to the people in their elective capacity. The exemption of the judges from that is quite dangerous enough, and I know of no safe depository of the ultimate powers of the society but the people themselves. And if we think them not enlightened enough to exercise their control with a wholesome discretion, the remedy is not to take it from them, but to inform their discretion by education. This is the true corrective of abuses of constitutional power. Pardon me, sir, for this difference of opinion. My personal interest in such questions is entirely extinct, but not my wishes for the longest possible continuance of our government on its pure principles. If the three powers maintain their mutual independence of each other, it may last a long time, but not so if either can assume the authorities of the other. Now, that was Thomas Jefferson's opinion. Now, let's take a break here, and we'll come back, and we'll take a look at John Marshall's opinion concerning judicial review. You're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and the Law School, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's eight schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives, and all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements, these recommendations that we give, do not mean that those authors or publications that we're endorsing will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review, they may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Or georgegordon.org, or you can call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing a publication entitled The Supreme Court. That's the title of the story that we're reporting on. It's put out by the Foundations of Liberty. That's the title of the publication, the article called The Supreme Court. And the publisher is the Reverend James R. Patrick, who is the editor of Foundations of Liberty. And they're located in East Moline Christian School, the East Moline Christian School, 946th Avenue, East Moline, Illinois. And their zip code is 61244. They run a private school. Their telephone number is 309-796-1485, if you want to call them. Again, that's area code 309-796-1485. If you just called them up and said, I heard your story on the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and I liked it or I didn't like it, you might call them up and say, I think that was the biggest piece of trash that I've ever heard. To make your opinion known, I think that they would probably appreciate that. If nothing else, they would know that somebody heard their opinion, whether you agreed with it or not. So, we just heard the story from Thomas Jefferson. Now, Jefferson's view was that constitutional power could best be preserved by the direct vote of the people through the states by way of education. John Marshall didn't think that was the case. Now, John Marshall was the second Chief Justice of the United States. John Jay was number one. Marshall served from about, I think it was about 1801 or something like that, to about 1835, around that neighborhood. So he was on the bench for about 34 years, as I recall, 35 maybe. He was there for a long time, Chief Justice. And in the early days of the Republic, he was one of the authors of a case, for instance, like Marbury versus Madison, which Thomas Jefferson disagreed with. So no matter which side you come down on here, the bottom line is the Supreme Court is, in fact, the final arbiter of law here in the United States. Like it or lump it, you know, that's the way the game is played. Jefferson thought that the judicial review approach was inappropriate, and that's because judges serve for life. And when we go to the Bible, we find that that's indeed true. Judges serve for life. They're not elected. Moses was never elected. There was an election, though, once. Moses was subjected to an election process. It was called Korah's Rebellion. You can read about it in Numbers chapter 16. Called Korah's Rebellion. Now, between Korah's rebellion back at Mount Sinai and the present, I can't remember of judges being elected. Here in the United States, the lower judges in a lot of locations are elected. The people directly elect their judges. It's a political office. But the judges were instructed by Moses not to be political. They weren't to judge based upon rich or poor, but they were to judge righteous judgment. So this raises a question, well, what's righteous judgment and who decides? You know, ultimately, when you get down to the bottom line, who is it that decides what the law is or what it isn't? So here's Marshall's opinion. History demonstrated Jefferson's concerns to be well-founded. But so were John Marshall's anxieties borne out by the events of history. And while it was true that the federal government grasped for power through the finality of Supreme Court decisions, it was also true that many of the states refused to uniformly protect the civil rights of all of their citizens. John Marshall clearly and emphatically established this position when, as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, he announced in Marbury v. Madison that the Supreme Court was the exclusive and final arbiter of what was constitutional and what was not, and furthermore, that its decisions were binding on all branches of government. And Marshall was simply affirming what he had said during the Virginia Ratification Convention. And at that time, he had asked, to that quarter, or to what quarter will you look for protection from an infringement of the Constitution if you will not give the power to the judiciary? There is no other body that can afford such a protection. And Marshall based his conclusions on three provisions of the Constitution. First was the Supremacy Clause, which says, this Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, shall be the supreme law of the land. That's Article 6. And secondly, the Binding Clause, which says all executive and judicial officers, both of the United States and of the several states, shall be bounded by oath and affirmation to support this Constitution. That's also in Article 6. And the Judicial Power Clause, which says the judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution, the laws of the United States, etc., and that's in Article 3, Section 2. So in spite of Jefferson's protests, Marbury v. Madison became the milestone case which gave the Supreme Court the last say on what was and was not constitutional. Now, had the court restrained itself during the ensuing years and held to a strict interpretation of the intent of the founders, its credibility would have remained untarnished. Unfortunately, however, its original position of defending constitutional supremacy gradually shifted to the defense of judicial supremacy, just as Jefferson had feared. And that is where the matter rests today. Now, there is a need for fixed rules of law. And no doubt one of the main reasons the rule of Marbury versus Madison became the cornerstone for judicial review was the fact that it brought questions of law to a final decision, whereas the Jefferson approach did not. It is part of human nature to demand a decision on pending issues that have a fixed rule of law, so people can get on with their affairs and conduct themselves accordingly. It reminds me of the old military cliche which proclaimed it's better to make a decision and be wrong than to make no decision at all. The federal courts have done just that. But once they abandoned the touchstone of the Constitution as originally designed by our founders, they began to wander very far afield. And in recent times, the Supreme Court has found itself facing a barrage of criticism resulting from reversing itself over 100 times and frequently interpreting statutes quite differently from the obvious intent of the Congress. Furthermore, it often bases decisions on public policy and modern doctrines, resulting in distorted interpretations of the Constitution, which the founders never would have recognized. Now, here's the correct way to interpret the Constitution. Now, of course, this could have been prevented if the courts had stayed with the doctrine of constitutional supremacy and constitutional interpretation of the Constitution according to the original intent of our fathers. The founders left no doubt as to how this document should be read. When Jefferson became president, here's what he said. He said, "The Constitution on which our Union rests shall be administered by me according to the safe and honest meaning contemplated by the plain understanding of the people of the United States at the time of its adoption, a meaning to be found in the explanations of those who advocated, not those who opposed it. These explanations are preserved in the publications of the time." Later, Jefferson emphasized the same views. He said, "On every question of construction, let us carry ourselves back to the time when the Constitution was adopted. Recollect the spirit manifested in the debates, and instead of trying what meaning may be squeezed out of the text or invented against it, conform to the probable one in which it was passed." Now, Jefferson felt the Constitution should be interpreted strictly, and he wrote, "When an instrument admits two constructions, the one safe and the other dangerous, the one precise, the other indefinite, I prefer that which is safe and precise. I had rather ask an enlargement of power from the nation, where it is found necessary, than to assume it by a construction which would make our powers boundless. Our peculiar security is in the possession of a written constitution. Let us not make it a blank paper by construction." Now, these comments are similar to those expressed by the other leaders in the early chapters of the country's history. Chief Justice Taney expressed the traditional view of the founders when he wrote, "If the Constitution or Constitution speaks not only in the same words, but with the same meaning and intent with which it spoke when it came from the hands of its framers and was voted on and adopted by the people of the United States, any other rule of construction would abrogate the judicial character of the court and make it the mere reflect of the popular opinion or passion of the day." And in a textbook, Taney wrote, "The first and fundamental rule in the interpretation of all instruments is to construe them according to the sense of the terms and the intentions of the parties." Now, the danger signals appeared very early in our history. In spite of the severe restrictions which were placed on the Supreme Court in its interpretation of the Constitution, it soon became apparent to Thomas Jefferson that the judicial body had the potential power of using judicial review to seriously distort the original intent of the founders by twisting the meaning of the Constitution. And though clever interpretations, Jefferson saw the possibility of the Supreme Court creating new laws and even using its opinions to unlawfully amend the Constitution. So in 1821, Jefferson wrote this. He said, "It has long, however, been my opinion, and I have never shrunk from its expression, that the germ of dissolution of our federal government is in the constitution of the federal judiciary, an irresponsible body, for impeachment is scarcely a scarecrow working like gravity by night and by day, gaining a little today and a little tomorrow, and advancing its noiseless step like a thief over the field of jurisdiction, until all shall be usurped from the states and the government of all to be consolidated into one. To this I am opposed. Because when all government, domestic and foreign, in little as in great things, shall be drawn to Washington as the center of all power, it will render powerless the checks and balances provided of one government on another, and it will become as venal and oppressive as the government from which we separated. Unquote. Now, in many respects, the justices of the Supreme Court restrained themselves for several generations. But eventually, the temptation to substitute their own wisdom for that of the Founding Fathers began to manifest itself with increasing frequency, just as Jefferson had predicted that it would. And the court's decisions began to transfer both political and economic power to Washington, D.C. The Supreme Court became so involved in using judicial review with non-constitutional interpretations that the founders would have undoubtedly accused the court of legislating in some cases and amending the Constitution in others. In both situations, the court was acting without authority, and there should have been some constitutional procedure which would nullify the Supreme Court's decisions. Now, nationalizing criminal justice was one of the problems. Another critical development is the intervention of the federal courts in the administration of criminal justice within the states. The 14th Amendment, with its Equal Protection Clause and its Due Process Clause, has been interpreted by the Supreme Court to mean that the federal Bill of Rights applies to the states as well as to the federal government. Now, this may seem perfectly innocent at first glance, since the rights of citizens should be protected. But in practice, it allows the federal courts to take over any state criminal case in which the defendant alleges that one or more of his civil rights as set forth in the first 8 amendments to the Constitution has been violated. Now, originally it was intended that civil rights would be protected by the states in state criminal cases and by the federal government in federal cases. However, this latest approach by the Supreme Court, designed to expand the protection of federal civil rights to state cases, has not only violated the original intent of the founders, but has clogged the dockets of the federal courts with a staggering caseload, which they are incapable of handling. In addition, it has seriously broken down the division of labor as well as the sovereign independence of the two levels of government as designed by our founding fathers. Now, I might make an editorial comment here that this 14th Amendment occurred as a result of the Civil War, and so it was political in nature, and it was imposed upon the southern states. Since the southern states wouldn't recognize the rights of blacks, the federal government stepped in and said, what we need is a constitutional amendment. Now, in order to pass a constitutional amendment, such as the 14th Amendment, you have to have 3/4 of all of the states. So, in order to get 3/4 of the states that were in the Union at the time, which were the Union states, the Congress took a poll and found out that they couldn't get 3/4 of the states to ratify the 14th Amendment. So they went down to the 11 southern states and they said, we are going to keep military occupation on you people down here until hell freezes over. Or you can cooperate. If you people down here in the South will ratify this 14th Amendment, we will take the yoke of military occupation off of your necks. So the legislatures of the southern states, combined with the legislatures of the northern states, when you put them together, you could come up with 75% of the states which would ratify the 14th Amendment. These are called the Reconstruction Amendments. The southern states didn't want to. The people of the South didn't want to. but they didn't want military occupation in it. So as a result of that, they chose the lesser of the two evils, well, what they perceived to be the lesser of the two evils. Now, the Supreme Court of Utah came to the fore, and I forgot the name of the case now. I think it was in the Gary Gilmore case, if my memory serves me right, but it may have been some other case, but it was a murder case. And the lawyers for the defendant went to the Supreme Court of the United States and said, hey, listen, these laws here in Utah are unconstitutional. And the Supreme Court of Utah wrote a treatise, a unanimous treatise. They came back and they said, now listen, it is true, and we concede, that the federal government and the Supreme Court of the United States, through judicial review, has the power over us to reverse our opinion. But it wasn't always so, and the 14th Amendment made it that way. And they came down and said it shouldn't be that way. That the power of the state is a co-equal branch of government, and that the federal government has usurped that power. And I'll leave it up to you. I think the Supreme Court of Utah hit the nail right on the head. In this debate between federal and state power, there isn't any debate to be held. It's the federal government is supreme. And you saw that out in the western states when Nevada and Wyoming said, we want to have a higher speed limit than 55 miles an hour. And the federal government said, well, that's fine. If you want to do that, you just get after it. But if you do, we're going to withhold federal funding for your highways. Now, in Nevada and Wyoming, that's the kiss of death, because you see, those two states only have about, you know, a million people each. I think Nevada might have a million people, but Wyoming's only got about a half a million people there. And it's a piece of real estate that's, you know, pushing 100,000 square miles. There's not enough people there to build a highway from one side of that state to the other. You have to have federal funds to build a four-lane highway. And to maintain and keep it up. And so they were forced by the federal government to submit through coercion. And that's the way the federal government's been working since the Civil War, by coercion. Now, in some cases, it's just by downright threat, as it was against the Mormons back in the 1870s and 80s, when the federal government said, you know, we're going to decide the religious doctrines of the Mormons. And our construction of religious doctrines don't include polygamy. Although polygamy is created by the creator of the universe, supported 24 times in the scripture, and God himself was a polygamist, and gave David 6 wives. But by golly, the Supreme Court of the United States and the federal government said, you're not going to have polygamy in Utah, and you people in Utah are going to practice Christian doctrine. And there's another example of federal supremacy over states' rights and the people's right to choose for themselves how they want to live. And I'm out of time. So I'm going to have to leave it there and remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.